From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a follow-up to our recent discussion of how the federal government is dealing with thousands of wild horses on federal land, the majority in Nevada and California. You'll hear from an equine behaviorist and a UC Davis animal science professor. Plus, an 11-year-old TV journalist who's traveled to LA, Hawaii, and Utah for her stories, and Austin, Texas-based singer-songwriter Raina Rose. First, California state parks are suffering from years of neglect. A huge maintenance backlog is built up in large part because of the state's ongoing deficit. A team of journalists is investigating and recently visited dozens of state parks. They're all reporters at McClatchy-owned newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee, the Modesto Bee, and the Merced Sun-Star. The first report came out yesterday. Four of those reporters join us, two in our studio. We'll start with them both at the Sacramento Bee, Margie Lundstrom and Matt Weiser. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning.
Margie, where did the story get started?
Well, this has been an idea that's been kicking around in the newspaper for a couple of years, but it was an idea that just really didn't have a news peg. And with the initiative coming up on the November ballot that would impose a vehicle license fee to fund the state parks or fund a portion of them, we thought this would be a really good time to take a hard look at the parks. So we rolled it out this year.
So, Matt, this was a story that had been building for some time but lacked a news hook. What had been building for a long time?
Well, the maintenance backlog in the parks had been building for a long time, and we had been aware of that, hearing from readers and our own personal experiences in the parks. So we decided to get a hold of the Parks Department's maintenance database, which lists all of these issues in the parks.
Yeah. Give us an idea of how big the backlog is.
Well, according to this database, the entire backlog is $1.3 billion. When we went out to take a look at the parks, we found a lot of things that were not in the database. So it's fair to say that that's a conservative number.
Margie, as we all know, when you neglect maintenance, you're usually deferring more expensive expenses down the line. Does that appear to be the case with the state parks too?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Matt and I were just discussing, it does appear that because things have been neglected so long, they're looking at price tags, quadruple what they were looking at prior, had they fixed it, on time.
In some cases, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a state budget problem or was something else behind this?
Well, I think it's a little of both. Of course, it's a budget problem because the money isn't there to do all this work, but it seems to be a political problem as well because our lawmakers haven't been able to deal with this issue. And to some extent, it's an issue with the people who use the parks, too. For years, the voters in California have been eager to approve bonds for more parks, but have not been that interested in covering the fees required to keep them up. So the money, as we've added more parks, the workload has gone up, but the money to maintain them has not changed.
So if I hear you correctly, even if the state were not having budget problems, there's been a building political problem for funding state parks.
I think that's a fair thing to say, yeah.
We're talking about the state of California's state parks. A team of journalists at five McClatchy-owned newspapers in California are documenting what's happening at the state parks in California, where there's a huge maintenance backlog. The reporters include Margie Lundstrom and Matt Weiser of the Sacramento Bee. Let's bring into the conversation two other reporters that are on the phone. Jamie Oppenheim, who's a reporter at the Merced Sun-Star. Jamie, welcome.
Hi, Jeffrey.
What's your contribution? What park or parks did you visit?
Parks in Merced County, so San Luis Reservoir, George Hatfield State Recreation Area, McConnell State Recreation Area as well, and then Great Valley Grasslands Parks.
How did you get involved in this? Was this something that you were assigned to do, or did you say, hey, this sounds interesting, I'd like to work on that?
I said, hey, this sounds interesting. I mean, what better way to get out of the office and,
No doubt about that. Tell us what you found.
So I found that, most of the more well-trafficked parks, the actual physical appearance of the parks, like the bathrooms, were, pretty clean and well-maintained. But yet behind the surface, there were still a lot of issues. So like sewer problems and those were some of the major problems facing those parks. And then the less trafficked parks seem to have more visible signs of disrepair, such as, you know, bathrooms that were obviously having serious problems, clogging constantly, and, you know, grills, or some of the grills were not maintained. The parking lots were not maintained as well.
John Holland, who's an agriculture reporter at the Modesto Bee and also part of the State of the State Parks project, is also on the phone. John, welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Tell us what parks you visited.
I visited Columbia State Historic Park and Railtown 1897 State Historic Park, which are both in Tuolumne County and very popular with people in the Modesto area. And as the name suggests, for both parks, they are historic parks, and they are popular because they have a lot of old things that people love to see. And that's the heart of the problem, is that it's really hard to keep things up that have been there for well over 100 years now.
What did you find?
In Columbia, we found that there's actually, the public sees quite a bit that's pretty fascinating, but behind the scenes there are foundations that could be undermined by drainage problems and roof leaks and plumbing and electrical problems. And if they don't have enough attention, the park someday could get to the point where a lot more has to be closed off than what they close off currently.
Margie Lundstrom, give us an idea of a park you visited and what you saw.
You know, I think one of the most interesting parks that I went to was up north of Placerville, Gold Discovery. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, quite a popular park for fourth grade field trips. And what you see is a lot, you know, they have so many historic structures there, about 80 historic structures. They have a real difficult time maintaining those structures. And virtually, I would say, the superintendent indicated that virtually every roof there is leaking. And what's at risk are the artifacts inside. You know, and that's going to be an issue that we'll tackle, I think, later on this summer, are the artifacts that are imperiled by this kind of maintenance.
And you, Matt Weiser, give us a park you visited and what you saw.
Well, I visited McCarracher State Park, which is on the north coast, north of Fort Bragg. And I went there fairly well aware of what the problems were because I'd looked at the database. I knew that it had issues with the water system. And I got there, and just 2 days before, the park staff had put up notices warning people not to drink the water because it had failed a water quality standard. And the notices said that if people needed water, they should go to Russian Gulch State Park, which is probably 15 miles further down the coast. So that's not a very convenient solution. Then I got to Russian Gulch State Park, and it was also posted with notices saying that its water was not up to snuff. The condition of the water there, according to the notices, was not as bad, but nevertheless, it was worrisome.
And your general beat at the Sacramento Bee is water, so that's, I guess, why you were looking specifically at water issues.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jamie Oppenheim at the Merced Sun Star, anything that officials, workers, or visitors at the park you visited stand out?
Well, one of the bathrooms at George Hatfield Park, you know, clogs at least 5 or 6 times a day.
Oh, dear.
So that was pretty noticeable. But, I mean, it's a 30 to 40-year-old, you know, sewer system that they're dealing with. So, yeah.
And John Holland of the Modesto Bee, anything you heard that stands out?
At Railtown, the bathrooms are fine, the same with Columbia, and the general appearance is fine. But when we were at Railtown, they were working on a wiring problem that could have been a real problem, could have caused injury to people at the park, in a park that they visit it,
yeah,
and they happen to catch it. What stands out at Railtown also is that they have this really wonderful collection of very old engines and cars, but there's just not enough money to do it. We happened to get there on the day when they were finishing the restoration of the movie train, locomotive number 3, which is famous for being in the movies. And that's an example. That took several years. It took $1.5 million, and it took a long time to raise that money. And they've got plenty more just waiting kind of back hidden away that they don't have the money for.
And FYI, we're going to be talking about that train restoration later this week on Insight. Margie Lundstrom, what about at the state parks offices in Sacramento? Is that part of the picture? Are you and the others focusing on policy here, or is it a ground level report looking at what's happening in the parks themselves?
I think it'll be both. I think we'll really get into a lot of policy and politics when we deal with what we're calling encroachment issues. The legislature has tackled this virtually every year for the past 10 years, which are competing land uses backing up to our parks that are really incompatible with what the parks were intended for. And there just simply hasn't been any legislation to address that. So that will be a story where we'll really focus heavily on policy.
Well, the first installment was published yesterday. There are three more installments coming up. Matt, in July, the topic is crimes in our parks. Any reason to think crime is increasing in the parks with the reduced financing?
Well, yes and no. Last year, I did a story about this using the parks crime database. And that database showed, in fact, that crime has been up significantly. And the reason for that is, again, budget issues, because the workforce of park rangers has not kept pace with the workload in the parks. But the latest version of that database, which we'll be writing about later, covers the year 2009, and it shows an overall decrease in crime, which we've also seen in urban areas throughout the state recently. Various journalists have made an attempt to explain that. It could be economics are reducing crime. But that seems to be reflected in parks. However, the data indicates that crimes physically against the parks, like resource-type crimes, vandalism, tree cutting, illegal hunting and fishing in the parks, those appear to be up in 2009. So we're going to be taking a closer look at that.
Margie Lundstrom, when we started this discussion, you mentioned the initiative in the November ballot, which relates to funding for the state parks, and the September report in the State of the State Parks series is Can We Afford the State Parks? Remind us what this initiative would do.
Well, this initiative is following another state that has tried this, which is to impose an $18 fee when you register your vehicle. And rather than pay for day use of a park, when you register your car in California, you would be allowed, with a current registration, day use of the park.
Yeah.
And it would raise a significant amount of money, but it, you know, of course, people say it would not solve the maintenance backlog.
Well, wouldn't it also reduce revenues? I mean, if you get into the park free in exchange for your vehicle license fee, well, how do we know the parks would be better off?
Yeah, we asked the Parks Department about that. The initiative would raise roughly $500 million. The majority of that would go to the Parks Department. And if you assume that the legislature then takes away the general fund contribution that goes to parks now, and you lose the visitor fees that the parks get now, they would net an additional approximately $208 million from this initiative, which is on top of the total that they get now. So it would help chip away at that maintenance database, but it would still take a long time to eliminate it.
Finally, if I may, and just briefly, Margie Lundstrom, there's been a significant development in another story that you've been working on, and we talked about with you on Insight relating to Sacramento County's CPS. What happened last week?
Yes, the top leadership of Sacramento County Child Protective Services sat down with me and discussed that there were a significant number of mistakes made and systemic problems within the agency with respect to how they handled the case of Amariana Crenshaw, who died at age 4 in foster care. And it was a really surprising but compelling conversation with the agency.
So is there reason to think that big changes are ahead?
You know,
because we've got to bear in mind that the Sacramento County has huge budget pressures,
yes,
and is cutting dozens of staff at CPS.
You know, certainly they have rolled out what appears to be an ambitious plan for change. And you know what was interesting about it that Laura Coulthard said was this recognition that not all changes have to be expensive. They don't have to cost. It can be a different way of doing business.
Well, thank you so much. Our main topic was the state of California state parks. It's a series happening this summer at 5 McClatchy-owned newspapers in California, including the Sacramento Bee, the Modesto Bee, and the Merced Sun-Star. Four of the reporters working on this joined us, Margie Lundstrom and Matt Weiser of the Sacramento Bee in our studio, and on the phone, Jamie Oppenheim of the Merced Sun-Star and John Holland at the Modesto Bee. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to Insight. Coming up, more on America's Wild Horses, a follow-up to our discussion of how the government is dealing with thousands of wild horses and burros on federal land. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Our recent topic on Insight was wild horses on federal land. There are thousands of wild horses in burrows on land managed by the BLM. The feds have been rounding up some wild horse herds and putting them in holding facilities. An animal rights group is leading a campaign against that practice. A Washington state-based expert on horse behavior visited Sacramento last week, which I should note was before I lost my voice. She's Mary Ann Simons, and I asked her how she thinks wild horses are doing in America today.
Well, not very well. I think we are on the brink of losing horse culture. The horse has never been proved to have ever completely died out in North America, and there is some good data to substantiate the fact that the Chinese and North American Indians in the Northwest might have been trading up until fairly recently pre-Columbian with horses. And what we've seen since I started my work 37 years ago, working with wild horses specifically to try to help in the management and preservation, we have mayhem out there. The cultures are disturbed. The populations are unstable. And our government continues to choose to remove them.
When you say we're on the brink of losing horse culture, what does that mean?
When I was on the National Advisory Board in 1992.
The board for?
The Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Board. I was selected to be on representing wildlife. It was a 9-member board. And our advisory board, from very much different walks of life, we specifically came up with a strategic plan, submitted it to the BLM, submitted it to Congress, that identified the behavioral herd wisdom as a management tool. We outlined a management tool that used behavior, decision-making, learned behavior, identifying cultures as a management tool. That's never been implemented. And so the culture of horses is as varied in some ways as the culture of humans. It's based on the habitat, learned behavior, and leadership. But those of us on the advisory board that were involved in the science recognize that by managing, using science to manage horses and understanding their culture, we could manage two directions, one for the genetic preservation and the other for the population control.
So when you say, when you refer to horse culture, you're talking about the lives of horses as opposed to the human culture associated with horses.
Correct. The lives of culture, the cultural life of a horse are different. One of the studies that we have in ISPMB, which is the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros in South Dakota, there are four different herds, and we're working with Princeton University and Dr. Cassandra Nunez now to identify the functional behaviors and the culture of those different herds. And so it's a comparison. Different herds, different areas behave differently. And we're looking to identify functional cultural behaviors in the horses. And then we have one herd that went through a lot of management, a lot of removals. And in 5 years, they have failed to form social bonds and are, in our opinion, pretty dysfunctional. But we need the science to identify those.
Mary Ann Simons is an equine behavioral ecologist. And also with us is Jan Roser, who's a professor in the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis. She's an equine specialist. Jan, welcome.
Thank you.
Does Mary Ann's analysis of the state of wild horses ring true to you? The country is on the brink of losing horse culture, as she says?
You know, I agree. I think the Bureau of Land Management needs to realize that these horses are indigenous to North America. I mean, I don't know how many people in this country realize that these horses grew up here in North America. And the reason we lost them is during the Ice Age, when they actually went over the Barrier Strait into Asia. And then, of course, they came back via Mexico. And certainly the genetics are different from the ones that were here, you know, 30, 40, 50 million years ago. But
how can they be indigenous then if they're genetically that different and the ancestral species had left the continent for such a long period of time?
I think it's in concept more than in reality in terms of physiology. It's in concept. They were here. They were here. They were born here. They grew up here. I feel that we own them because of that.
But when it comes to species that... Well, I guess non-native species, just because something was born here doesn't make it an indigenous species. I mean, the horses have been here for since the Spanish and the Mexicans arrived for several hundred years. So those horses have been here that time. But you have to go back thousands of years to find the previous generations of horses that you said are genetically different.
Well, true. There are fossils found of the horses that were here millions of years ago. And indigenous, I mean, what is the definition of indigenous?
Well, I'm not the expert. I'm just the person who asks questions.
I think, to me, it means that it's the birthplace of the animal. Whether they go away and come back, this is still their birthplace.
Okay. Marianne?
Well, I was going to comment on that because for the last 37 years, I seem to have been collecting data from different sources accidentally and intentionally, but there's a lot of anecdotal information of horse bones and artifacts that have been put aside because science feels, well, the horse died out, therefore. But when you look at assumptions, science is not about making assumptions. Science is about questioning. And we do not have conclusive data that the horse ever died out. There is anthropological and maritime data, the data being exchanged with the Chinese. And as soon as we get genetics markers that on the genetic ability in China to look at some of the horses there, much of the interpretation in the 14, 1300s were documenting horse exchanges with Chinese in the Northwest. And even though we do not have anything conclusive, it's about questioning. Equus lambii, which was the tundra horse that Jay Kirkpatrick talked about, is the same genetically as Equus caballus, which is modern horse. So I think we have to question, did the horse ever die out, or did it go into small northern populations and the Spanish reintroduced in the southern?
But there is scientific research that says they did die out. We can't resolve that in the program today. But how would this affect the discussion over how to deal with wild horses in America today? How would it change for you if it were proven there had been a long period of time without horses in North America? Would that change the way you think the wild horses of today should be treated?
That's a good question. No, not a bit. I mean, that's a secondary piece that's kind of nice. Horses are part of the American culture. They're written in the act to preserve the behavior, you know, that basically they're our heritage. And it's an indication of a throwaway society. As soon as we're done with it, we throw it away, and horses are no exception. They were given to the Land Management Agency when the act was passed, and they probably should have been given either to the Park Service or to a separate agency that understood and knew the behavior of the animal as an individual species.
Jan Rosa, same question to you. Would it make any difference to you in the treatment of wild horses in America if it were shown conclusively that they had been absent from the continent for an extended period?
No, I agree with Marianne. They are our heritage, and they go back far enough. The Wild West, the Indians, the American Indians, it is part of our history, and they should stay part of our history. And there's no reason to let them disappear. And I think the public, you know, would support the presence of these animals. I truly believe that the major portion of the public would want them to stay there. And I mean, these are beautiful animals, and the public realizes that, and they're in the wild, and that's where they should stay and grow. And
as I understand, part of the conflict over this is what appears to be, and I haven't been there, so I can't testify to it, what appears to be competition for the eating and water resources among the animals. You've got the horses, and you've got the cattle and other livestock. How would we know when there was a reasonable balance between the number of horses and the amount of livestock? Marianne?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked that. I did some of the original range competition studies back in 1972-73 at the University of Wyoming, which were used in the National Academy of Sciences to say that there was significant overlap between cattle and horses. There was not in the studies I did. I'm not sure how they got significant out of most of the dietary overlap on some of the habitats were with elk, not cattle. Cattle were dominant eating crested wheatgrass, and horses were more dominant eating western wheatgrass, which is a native species. So I question the science behind the statement that there is overlap. When you really look at forage production and you look at what's happening with removals consistently through a number of years, there have been areas where, yes, indeed, we needed to population manage all species, and in other areas, not at all. And when you look look at numbers and you think, you know, let's just take Colorado, for instance, 120,000 elk, and they consider that not enough, you know, 180,000 in Nevada, and we're scraping by with 22,000 horses. This, from a genetic pool, is not enough. So dietary, what they call AMLs, or the management levels that are set, I think we need more science behind that before we set. There's plenty of forage out there in some cases, and the horses are the last on the list to get anything.
Well, what do you think should be done, not just at the government level, the BLM level, the agency that currently has responsibility for the wild horses, but among the ranchers in the West and the population at large? What would you recommend, and this question is for both of you, what would you recommend about how to deal with, how to view the appropriate population size of the wild horses and what they deserve and what they don't deserve?
Well, Jen, do you mind if I go on that one a little bit?
Sure.
What
do
you think?
Yeah.
We're dealing with a bigger issue, and the bigger issue is a paradigm shift in all of how we raise animals. And whether cattle are even going to be a part of the American diet in 40 years is being questioned. We don't have enough land to provide oil and gas and water and food for cattle. How do we look at that today? I think it's looking at a cultural need of humans. We submitted good recommendations in terms of look at the species, understand the species, at least a minimum of what we do for elk or deer, and manage them as a species. We have plenty of behavioral wild horse ecologists in the world. The BLM has none. So let's look at them as a species and see how they fit in. It is a cultural issue. It's not a population issue. Ranchers need to have money. They have a lifestyle they want to retain. We've proposed in the past ways to manage horses and cattle. I helped set up ecotourism on a number of Western ranches, which are making money showing wild horses today. We don't need to be helicoptering horses when we have good ranchers that can round up horses if we do need to do bands together in populations. So we don't have time today to go into it. There's many detailed reports with good recommendations to do this, and we have two issues. One is the culture and human side, and then only secondary is the population and the horse side.
John, was there any final thoughts from you?
Well, I think the cattle and the horses separate themselves out, not only due to the different forages, but horses tend to go more up into the hills than the cattle do. The cattle tend to stay more in the flat areas, and I think they separate themselves out. And I just want to know from BLM, you know, how much land are we talking about here that we can't have both? And I agree with Marianne about the way our diets are going. Are we going to be eating a lot of meat in the future?
Well, that's a question for the future. Of course, right now the BLM has to deal with what's going on today. So,
well, they've got to deal with what's going on today in terms of the future, because we are determining the future. If we do something so drastic as to get rid of these horses, then there is no future for them.
Jan Roser, professor in the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis. She's an equine specialist. And Marianne Simons, she's an equine behavioral ecologist. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much.
That conversation was recorded last week. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, an 11-year-old Sacramento girl pursuing a career in TV. Recently, she interviewed stars at a movie premiere in L.A. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous show, check our archives at capradio.org/insight. Being 11 years old is no impediment to being a TV journalist. Just ask Isabella Powers, a Sacramento girl who's host of Isabella's Animal Show on Access Sacramento and a contributing reporter to Kids Corp, a community cable show. She's interviewed movie stars and Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson and traveled as far as Utah and Hawaii for reports. She's in our studio. Isabella Powers, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, how did you get the idea to be a TV journalist?
TV journalist. Well, I've been in commercials since I was 2 years old. I've been acting for a while, and And, well, Marcus Allen with Mark at the Movies kind of gave the idea to me. He inspired me, and he, with 20th Century Fox, he asked me if I would like to go down to interview the stars for the premiere of Marmaduke, and I agreed, and there I was. It was very exciting.
Wow, well, that was just very recently.
Yes.
You started off, though, hosting a TV show with Isabella's Animal Show. Why did you decide to make a show with reports about animals?
Well, I really care for animals. I love animals. And it first started one day, I told my mom, I said, Mom, there's a couple things I want. I want to go back to Costa Rica, and I want to have my own animal show. And so she talked to my dad, and that happened, and I loved acting, and I love animals, and that made a show, Isabella's Animal Show.
You're very self-confident. You speak well on the microphone.
Thank you. Have you
always been that confident when you're on mic?
Yes, I've been, since I said 2 years old, I've been in commercials. I've been in multiple talent shows every year at my school. I've been acting in a couple short films, and I'm also a correspondent for a show called Kids Corporation.
Isabella Powers, she's an 11-year-old Sacramento girl, and she is pursuing a career in TV journalism and acting and who knows what else in her future. You've been around a bit interviewing people. You've been to Honolulu. Who did
yes.
you interview there?
Well, I interviewed the people who, just everyone, basically, the people who work there with...
At the zoo.
Yes, at the zoo with the turtles and the apes and the lemurs, and just went around and interviewed whoever was there and was available and was willing to do that and talk to me and give me their fantastic information.
How does someone like the director of the Honolulu Zoo react when an 11-year-old journalist contacts him and says, I'd like to come and interview you?
Well, I think they would probably be excited, like, whoa, what, 11-year-old girl? But it's good for that. It gives them heads up, and also it just really cool for them and good advertisement, and it's fun to have someone different instead of older people all the time.
You've also been to a goat farm in Utah. How did that happen, and what was it like?
Well, since I have family up in Utah, we just one time we were at the farmer's market, and we were trying some cheese and stuff, and that also brought to goats, and so we thought that was a great idea. My dad and I both looked at each other, and we're like, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And we're both like, yeah. And my grandparents knew them, so which worked really well. And we just went up there and talked about goats and information about that.
You've also interviewed Sacramento's mayor, Kevin Johnson. I've interviewed him a couple of times too. How did you approach interviewing the mayor?
Well, since I have my show Kids Corporation, we just go around all different places interviewing people, and we thought that would be a really good idea, and it would be different than just interviewing some bakery or some restaurant or anything like that. And we're like, oh, that would bring a catch to the viewer's eye, and that was a really good idea, we thought, and so that happened.
What did you ask him about?
Just kind of what he's going to do to be mayor, what his own personal life is, do you have any pets? And we asked him at the end, do you like playing checkers? And he said, yes, and I gave him a checkerboard, and I said, I'll challenge you to a game of checkers, and later, we played a game of checkers, and that's also starting in our new production.
Did you beat him?
No. I didn't beat him.
He's a very competitive guy, I think.
Yes, but he's very nice at the same time.
Does he have pets?
Yes, he has one dog, which I can't exactly remember, because that was a while ago, but he has a dog, and he talked about his dog and how he likes to play with his dog and interact with his dog.
My guest is TV journalist Isabella Power. She's an 11-year-old at St. Francis Elementary. She hosts Isabella's Animal Show on Access Sacramento, and she's a contributing journalist to Kids Corporation. What's your approach to interviewing people? Do you have a general way that you approach interviews? Maybe I can learn something from you.
Well, my dad's in advertising, and the director, basically, he kind of gets help to get the interviews, and my dad does too. And just kind of when you're walking down the street and you see someone, or basically just people you meet, you think, oh, that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
How about we do a story? And if they're willing to do it, then they're willing to do it, and we would love to do that story, and that's how it happens.
Well, that's pretty much how it works at Insight, too.
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of research?
Well, my dad and I do research for sometimes if we're doing Isabella's animal show, I have to get information on all the animals. And so I'm just not like, yeah, I don't know this. I have to give information like, here's some interesting facts about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, your biggest catch was interviewing George Lopez and Owen Wilson.
Yes.
Not too long ago at the premiere of the movie Marmaduke. They contributed voices to two of the main characters. What was that like?
Oh, that was just an awesome adventure for me because I've done many small interviews before, and this has been by far the biggest interview. And it brought me a different perspective of acting, and that journalism is very different, but it's different and it's fun.
I'm looking at two photographs of you. One, you appear to be at a red carpet, and you got mm-hmm. your microphone in George Lopez's face, and you're asking him
yes.
questions. What was he like?
Well, he was just answering the questions and just have to go along, and that's basically what happened.
And then you look like a real celebrity journalist in the other one. You're sitting at a waterfront with the actor Owen Wilson. You're sitting there just getting ready to tape an interview.
Yes, that was for the interview. My first interview before the red carpet, when George Lopez and Owen Wilson, they were both there, and I just asked them questions. But instead of I prepared to ask them questions, what kind of threw me off is they basically interviewed me. So it was very different than I thought it would be.
And finally, Isabella Powers, what are your long-term goals? Do you want to be a TV journalist when you're older, too?
I thought about that, and it's really fun and exciting. But ever since I was a kid, I've always wanted to be a doctor, and I finally decided that I want to be a cardiologist. So I'm going to stick with that goal.
Well, you could be like Dr. Oz, be a doctor
yeah,
who's on
doctor
TV.
Is.
doctor
yeah,
is.
Doctor is. I know.
That's great. Isabella Powers, I have a hunch you're going to do very well.
Thank you
so much for joining us.
Well,
on
thank you so much for your time.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Texas-based singer-songwriter Raina Rose on tour with a new album. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check out Insight on Facebook and say you like us. Austin, Texas-based singer-songwriter Raina Rose is touring the Western U.S. with her new album, When May Come. Today she's in Sacramento with a concert tonight at Old Ironsides. She and the band are in her studio, Raina Rose and Company. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having us.
Morning.
Raina, you got such a busy-looking summer. When I look at your schedule from basically June 22nd through August 15th, you're playing pretty much every day in a different city.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we have a driver with us, so we don't have to do the driving and the playing.
How did you feel on June 21st, the day before you set off?
We actually were at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival on that weekend, and that was amazing. The Telluride Bluegrass Festival was incredible.
I read in your bio that you love the Pacific Ocean more than just about anything in the world.
I do.
I have to ask you, why did you move from Portland to Austin?
Well, as much as I love the Oregon coast and Portland, Austin, Texas is an incredible music community. They also give musicians free health care in Austin.
Really?
Yeah, the organization is called HAM. It's the Health Alliance for Austin Musicians, and they give us free mental, dental, and health care.
Wow, I'd never heard that.
Yeah, it makes my mom real happy.
That's a pretty unusual situation, isn't it?
It is. Well, Austin calls itself the live music capital of the world, and I think that's just the city's way of putting its money where its mouth is.
So do you think there are other musicians who move there in part because of that?
I think it's definitely a factor in a lot of musicians' decision to move there. It's also just an incredibly fertile and giving music community. Everybody, it's not a competition there. Everybody just plays music because they like to play music.
And do they have some medical bureaucrat in Austin you have to go in and prove that you're a musician?
They
stamp some piece of paper and say, there you go.
It's kind of like that. But it was more just, I actually went in with my computer that had my calendar on it and a poster and a CD, and they took that as proof.
That was your proof?
Yeah, they make it really easy to be a part of.
My guest is Raina Rose. She's playing Old Ironsides in Sacramento tonight, and she's here with three other musicians who are playing with her, touring with her. Let's quickly meet them before we hear a song. Andrew Pressman, welcome.
Good morning.
You play what?
I play the bass.
And how long have you been playing with Raina?
I met Raina just over a year ago in Austin because she was booked at, or was about to get booked at the High Sierra Music Festival, which is a festival I've gone to every single year for the last 4 or 5 years. And she didn't have a bass player, and I met Trevor, and he mentioned that to me, and I basically asked if I could play that gig with them. And then that since was my inlet to joining the band.
And what kind of music do you otherwise play?
Right now I play with a lot of songwriters, and I used to play a little bit of bluegrass when I moved to Austin. When I lived in California, I played electric bass and a lot of jam rock bands.
And the Trevor you just mentioned is Trevor Smith. Trevor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. What do you play?
I play the banjo on this adventure.
On this adventure, as opposed to?
Many a different instrument. I like to play the 8-string mandolin as opposed to the 10-string.
Oh, okay. And did you meet Raina in Austin? Are you an Austin guy, too?
I've lived there for about 4 years. This bluegrass band called Green Mountain Grass brought me there, and Raina Rose toured with us opening, and I started playing with her, too.
That's cool. And the third band member with us is Anthony DaCosta. Anthony, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
What do you play?
I play electric guitar.
How long have you been playing with Raina?
I met Raina several years ago at a
pre-Austin.
Pre-Austin. Yeah, I'm the only non-Austinite in the band. I live in New York City, but I met Raina several years ago at a conference, a folk music conference put on by the Folk Alliance.
Yes, there are such things as folk music conferences.
Sounds like the most easily defeated alliance in the world, but it's true. The Folk Alliance and Raina knew about. I was about to go to Kerrville, and Raina knew about Kerrville and offered to show me around there, and we started playing together not long after.
So are you Professor Raina Rose when you speak at conferences?
Oh, I don't speak.
She sings, though.
You sing?
I sing, yeah.
Well, speaking of which, you're all going to do a song for us in our studio. What's the song?
The song is called Sun Comes Back, and it's off our new album, When May Came.
Great, let's hear it.
So tall sometimes, singing like the chimes, a thin line I'm walking between a wild night and a bad time, a low tide. And I never been too good at hiding my designs. This you might find surprising. Fast apart, it's coming to you over the telephone wires, towers and the spires of towns of liars. Through your wet windowsill, I love you still, despite the scarecrows and my mind. It ain't right the time. I've been used, standing with a fuse, and you got my spark shining in the dark, flame against the sun, and you are the only one to change the seasons in my chest, so that I can rest.
The song is Sun Comes Back, played in our studio by Arena Rose and her band. They're playing Old Ironsides in Sacramento tonight. Andrew Pressman, I just heard you're the bassist. You used to live in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's correct. I lived in Sacramento from 2005 to 2008.
Yeah, then you moved to Austin. So
yeah.
What's it like to be back?
Well, it was...
I realize it's a flying visit.
Well, yeah. Well, we're going to be back here in the beginning of August, too. We have a couple of shows then, one at O'Malley's and one at, I believe, 1022, which is a restaurant in Old Town. It was kind of weird driving over the mountain last night from Reno. It was like, that was a drive I used to do all the time. And I was driving back like, wow, I used to be able to do this whenever I wanted. And now this is the only time I'm going to drive through Tahoe, probably all year in the middle of the night in the darkness.
Raina, I read in your MySpace blog that you were competing in a contest to win 100 hours of studio time from a studio in Austin. What's that about?
It was an interesting contest because we played against a poppy country duo and then a hardcore rock band, and then a band. What was the other band?
Some indie rock band. The one that actually won it. I don't remember what they were called, though.
Who votes?
We got voted in by our fans. But then three industry types were flown in and told to vote mainly on commercial viability, which I don't think is any of our focus. No. So
It's mine. It's mine. Which is probably why I'm not a permanent member of the band.
Yeah, they said, yeah, you guys are great. You guys are awesome.
We really liked what you did. It was really interesting and unique. Yeah, you didn't win.
The banjo player was totally hot, but nah.
They went to give us like a clinic and criticize what we did, and they had no criticism for us other than, you guys are awesome, but you can't win this because you're not commercially viable, which is totally fine.
Yeah. It was actually kind of a compliment.
Yeah.
100 hours of studio time would have been cool, though.
You bet.
Yeah.
Well, you're busy. You got your new album out.
Yeah.
And also lots of gigs. Tonight, Old Ironsides in Sacramento. And for our Nevada Cityites or Nevada citizens, I don't know what the correct word is, you're a Chief Crazy Horse.
Tomorrow night. That's right. Taco night.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Taco night with the Raina Rose situation.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Raina Rose, singer, songwriter with Andrew Pressman on bass, Trevor Smith on banjo, Anthony DaCosta lead guitar. Thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a blast.
And that's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Sosin Morar, Natalie Rothfels, and Mara Ponce. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. At Insight, we have one goal.
That's an interesting... I've never been asked that question before.
Good.
Very good question.
That is such a good question.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That is such a great question.
That's a really good question.
From scientists, lawmakers, artists, interesting people of every stripe.
Well, you have a really uncorked Pandora's box with that with that question.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.